was pleased with himself, and even more pleased that Etienne had been there to see it. When the boys decided to visit the beaver dam again, Matt was unwilling to leave the rabbit behind in case some thieving animal should discover it. He was walking behind Etienne, swinging the rabbit carelessly by the ears, as Etienne always did, when the Indian suddenly halted. His whole body tensed. Matt could see nothing unusual, and he had opened his mouth to speak when Etienne silenced him with a jerk of his hand. Then he heard a sound in the underbrush ahead. Not a rustle like a grouse or a snake, not a trapped animal. This was a stirring of something moving slowly and heavily. He felt a cold prickle in his stomach. He stood beside Etienne, his own muscles tight, scarcely breathing. A low bush bent sideways. Through the leaves, a brown head thrust itself, bigger than that of a dog and shaggier. It was a small bear cub. Matt could see the little eyes peering at them curiously, the brown nose wrinkling at the strange smell of human boy. The little animal looked so comical that Matt almost laughed out loud. "Sst!" Etienne warned under his breath. There was a crashing of bush and a low, snarling growl. An immense paw reached through the thicket and tumbled the cub over and out of sight. In its place loomed a huge brown shape. Bursting through the leaves was a head three times as big as the cub's. No curiosity in those small eyes, only an angry reddish gleam. Somehow Matt had the sense not to run. He stood frozen on the path. A bear could overtake a running man in a few bounds, and this one was only two bounds away. The bear's head moved slowly from side to side. Its heavy body brushed aside the branches as though they were cobwebs. It swayed, shifting its weight from one foot to the other. Slowly it rose on its hind legs. Matt could see the wicked, curving claws. Matt would never know why he acted as he did. He could not remember thinking at all, only staring with numb horror at the creature about to charge. Somehow he did move. He swung the dead rabbit by its ears and hurled it straight at the bear's head. The tiny body struck the bear squarely on its nose. With a jerk of her head, the bear shook it off as though it were a buzzing mosquito. The rabbit flopped useless to the ground. The bear did not even bother to look down at it. She had been distracted for only an instant, but in that instant something flashed through the air. There was a sharp twang and the dull thud of a blow. Just between the eyes of the bear, the shaft of Etienne's arrow quivered. As the waving forepaws began to lower, a second arrow struck just below the bear's shoulder. The great head shuddered and sank toward the ground. With a wild yell, Etienne sprang forward and thrust his knife deep just behind his first arrow. Still, scarcely aware that he moved at all, Matt leaped after him. Jerking his own knife from his belt, he sank it into brown fur. His blow had been misplaced, but it was not needed. The bear's sides were heaving. The boy stood watching, and in a few moments, it lay still. Matt stared down at the creature in horror. The fearsome yellow teeth were still bared in a snarl. Saliva and blood dribbled down from the open jaws. The little eyes that had glittered so savagely were filmed over. The long, sharp claws hung powerless, clotted with pawed up earth. Now that there was nothing to fear, Matt felt his knees shaking. He hoped that Etienne would not notice, and he managed a wide grin to hide his trembling. But Etienne did not grin back. He stood over the bear, and he began to speak, slowly and solemnly, in his own tongue. He spoke for some time. "What were you saying?" Matt demanded when the speaking was over. "I tell bear I do not want to kill," Etienne answered. "Indian not kill she-bear with cub. I tell bear we did not come here to hunt."
"But it might have killed us both."
"Maybe. I ask bear to forgive that I must kill."
"Well, I'm mighty thankful you did," Matt said stoutly. He was about to say that he had never been so scared in his life, but he thought better of it.
Etienne looked at him, and his solemnness suddenly dissolved in a grin.
"You move quick," he said, "like Indian."
Matt felt his cheeks turn red.
"You killed him," he said honestly.
Yet he knew that he had had a part. He had given Etienne just that instant in which to notch his arrow. Etienne nudged the bear with his toe.
"Small," he said. "Just same fat. Good for eat."
"Small?
That monstrous creature? It certainly was too big for two boys to carry. It appeared that Atien had no intention of trying.
"Belong squaw now," he said. "I go tell."
"You mean a squaw is going to carry that heavy thing?"
"Cut up meat, then carry."
"Squaw work," Atien answered. It was plain that he had done the man's work and was finished with it. The cub, Matt remembered now. It was nowhere in sight.
Atien shook his head. "Let cub go," he said. "When Sigwan come again, him plenty big to eat."
"Take rabbit," Atien reminded him. Matt looked with distaste at the rabbit, almost covered by the bear's heavy paw, the fur matted and bloody. He would rather not have touched it, but obediently he pulled it out. It was his dinner, after all, and he knew that in Atien's world everything that was killed must be used. The Indians did not kill for sport. When Atien had disappeared into the forest, Matt still stood looking down at the first bear he had ever seen. He felt resentful. Atien had killed the bear, of course. It was his by right. But Matt would have liked just a small share of that meat, or even one of those big claws to show his father. Then he remembered the Indian boy's tribute. He had moved fast, like an Indian. That would have to be share enough. Chapter 16. In the late afternoon, Matt sat in the cabin doorway. He couldn't think of any work to do. He felt restless, the excitement still jumping about inside him. He needed to talk to someone. He wanted to tell his father about the bear. Thinking of his father, he felt that snake of worry crawling about behind every other thought. That worry was becoming more frequent every day. What could have kept his father so long? Suppose some accident had befallen him. The meeting with the bear had shaken Matt's trust in the forest. Now it seemed to close him in on every side, dark and threatening. Suppose his father had met with a bear. Suppose he had never got back to Quincy. How would his mother know where to find this place, or even where to send anyone to look for him? Matt hugged his arms around his chest, but the cold was inside. It would not go away. Something moved at the edge of the woods. Matt leaped to his feet. A stranger came walking into the clearing. With an ugly chill against his backbone, Matt stared at the hideously painted face. Then he recognized Atien, a very different Atien from the boy who had walked with him in the forest that morning. The Indian boy had washed his body, and it shone with fresh grease. He had combed his tangled black locks. Down his cheeks on either side and on his forehead ran broad streaks of blue and white paint. On a cord around his neck dangled a row of new bear's claws. In case Atien had noticed his first alarm, Matt greeted him boldly. "What's the war paint for?" he demanded.
"Not war paint," Atien answered. "Squaws make feast with bear. My grandfather say you come."
Matt hesitated, unable to believe his ears. It took him a moment to realize that this was actually an invitation.
"Thanks," he stammered. "I'd sure like some of that bear meat. Wait till I get my jacket."
"Shut door," Atien reminded him. "Maybe another bear come."
Atien was in a good humor. He had made one of his unexpected jokes.
"Long way," Atien said after a time.
Matt was certain they must have been walking fast for more than an hour. He remembered that Atien had already walked all this way to fetch him, and he kept silent. It was so dark now that he could barely see to put one foot before the other, but he realized that they were on a well-beaten trail. Just as the last light was glinting above the treetops, they reached a riverbank. Drawn up at its edge was a small birch canoe. Atien motioned him to step into it. Then he gave a push and leaped nimbly into the stern. His paddle moved soundlessly. Grateful to sit still, Matt was entranced by the speed, the silence, the gliding shadows on the Silver River. He was regretful when in a very few strokes they reached the other side. Now Matt could see a glimmer of light deep in the woods. Atien led him toward it, and presently their way was barred by a solid wall of upright posts. A stockade. For the first time, a quiver of uneasiness made Matt falter. But stronger than any doubt, curiosity drove him on. Not for one moment would he have turned back. Eagerly he followed Atien through a gateway into an open space filled with smoke and moving shadows and wavering patches of light cast by birch bark torches. All around him in a circle rose the dim shapes of cabins and cone-shaped wigwams. In the center of a circle, a long, narrow fire was burning between walls of logs. Suspended on timbers hung three iron pots, sending up rosy curls of steam in the smoky air. The fragrance of boiling meat and pungent herbs made Matt's stomach crawl. Then he was aware of the Indians. They sat silently on either side of the fire, their painted faces ghastly in the flickering light. They were clad in an odd medley of garments, some in Englishmen's coats and jackets, others with bright blankets draping their shoulders. A few had feathers standing straight up from headbands. Everywhere there was the gleam of metal on arms and chests. Women in bright cloth skirts and odd pointed caps moved about without a sound, adding wood to the fire or stirring the contents of the kettles. Light glinted on their silver armbands and necklaces. Clearly, the Indians had put on their finest array for this feast. It came over Matt with a rush of shame how very shabby he must look in their eyes. Even if Etienne had warned him, what could he have done? He had no other clothes to wear. Probably Etienne had known that and so had said nothing. No one seemed to notice him. Yet he was conscious of the unblinking stare of the row facing him. The others did not turn their heads. They seemed to be waiting. In the silence, Matt's heart beat so loudly they all surely must have heard it. After a long pause, one man rose slowly and came toward him. It was Sacnis, his paint-streaked face barely recognizable. He wore a long red coat decorated by a handsome beaded collar and metal armbands. A crown of feathers rose from the beaded band around his forehead. He stood very tall, and there was pride in his stern features. Why, Matt thought, he looked like a king.
"Kwai," Sacnis said with dignity. "White boy, welcome."
In a sudden, terrifying yell, the rows of Indians echoed this greeting.
"Taho," they shouted. "Taho, yi hai hai."
"Kwai," Matt stammered in return. Then more boldly, "Kwai."
The Indians seemed satisfied. Smiles flashed in their dark faces. There was rough laughter, and then, seeming to forget him, they began to jabber to each other. From nowhere, children suddenly crowded around him, giggling, daring each other to touch him. Matt's heart slowed its pounding. There was nothing to fear in this place. But after the weeks of stillness in his cabin, the noise was confusing. He was grateful when Etienne came to his rescue and led him to a seat at the end of a log. An old woman approached and held out to him a gourd cup. It contained a sweetish drink, acid and flavored with maple sugar, good on his dry tongue. Sacnis raised his arm, and instantly the clamor was silenced. There was no doubt Etienne's grandfather was the leader here. An Indian brought him a long pipe, and Sacnis put it to his lips and slowly blew out a long wreath of smoke. The rows of Indians waited respectfully for him to speak. Instead, the old man turned to his grandson and held out the pipe. Etienne stepped into the center of the clearing. In the firelight, he stood straight and slender, his bare arms and legs gleaming. Matt had never seen him like this. Proudly, he took the pipe, set it briefly to his own lips, and handed it back to his grandfather. Then he began to speak. Matt did not need to understand the words. He soon realized that Etienne was recounting the morning's adventure. Watching his gestures, Matt felt himself living again the walk through the woods, the meeting with the small cub, the fearsome mother about to charge. As Etienne spoke, the Indians urged the boy on with grunts and shouts of approval and pleasure. Etienne tensed his body. He uttered a sharp cry, pointed at Matt, and made a flinging sweep of his arm, hurling an imaginary rabbit. The seated figures broke into loud cries, shouting, "Heh!" grinning and pointing at Matt, swinging their own arms in imitation. Matt's cheeks were hot. He knew they were making fun of him, but boisterous as it was, the sound was friendly. Now they turned back to Etienne and followed his story with growing excitement. Etienne certainly made a very good story of it. His telling took a lot longer than the actual event. Plainly, they all enjoyed it, and in listening, they were all taking part in it. Etienne was a skillful storyteller. Matt could understand now just how he must have delighted them with his acting out of Robinson Crusoe. When the narrative was over, the Indians sprang to their feet. They formed a long line. They began a sound that sent a tingle, half dread and half pleasure, down Matt's spine. A lone Indian had leaped to the head of the line, beating a rattle against his palm in an odd, stirring rhythm. He strutted and pranced in ridiculous contortions, for all the world like a clown in a village fair. The line of figures followed after him, aping him and stamping their feet in response. Etienne was at his side again. "Dance now," he said, "then feast." The rhythm of the rattle quickened. The line of figures wove round the fire, faster and faster. Women joined now, at the end of the line, linking their arms, swaying. Finally, the children, even small children, were dancing, stamping their small, naked feet. "Dance," Etienne commanded. He seized Matt's arm and pulled him into the moving line. The men near him cheered him on, laughing at Matt's stumbling attempts. Once he caught his breath, Matt found it simple to follow the step. His confidence swelled as the rhythm throbbed through his body, loosening his tight muscles. He was suddenly filled with excitement and happiness. His own heels pounded against the hard ground. He was one of them. He came back to earth with a stitch in his side. His legs threatened to give way under him. The dancing seemed to have no end. Determined that Etienne should not see him weakening, he moved faster and stamped harder. Finally, when he felt he could not make the circle one more time, the dance ended. The feasting began. A squaw brought him a wooden bowl filled with thick, hot stew and a curiously carved wooden spoon. The first steaming mouthful burned his tongue, but he was too hungry to wait. He thought nothing had ever tasted so good, dark and greasy and spicy. So this was bear meat. Presently he noticed that Etienne sat beside him, eating nothing. "You're not eating," he said with a sudden doubt. "Have you given me your share?"
"This my bear," the boy answered. "I kill, not eat. Maybe not get any more bear." He didn't sound as if he minded in the least, as if, in fact, he was proud of not eating. When Matt's bowl was empty, the squaw refilled it. By the time he finished, sleepiness began to drag at his eyelids. He could scarcely hold them open. Etienne seemed in no hurry to leave. The Indians were enjoying themselves, refilling their bowls, shouting at each other, laughing and slapping their legs at what seemed to be uproarious jokes. This was noisier than any celebration Matt had ever seen in Quincy, even on Muster Day. Why had he ever had the idea that the Indians were a dull lot? At last, however, they fell silent, and Matt saw that one of them was beginning another story. It promised to be a long one. Between the sentences, the speaker drew on his pipe, and the smoke curled from his nose and mouth as he spoke. Matt's head drooped and came up with a painful jerk. He had almost fallen asleep sitting up. Etienne laughed and motioned him to his feet. At the thought of tramping all the way back to the cabin, Matt groaned. It must be close to midnight. Then he saw that Etienne did not mean to go back. He led Matt toward one of the wigwams and pulled back the flap of deerskin that hung across the door. Inside, a small fire burned, and by its faint light, Matt saw a low platform covered with matting and fur. Etienne made a silent motion, and Matt, too sleepy to question, gratefully let his tired body sink down on the soft skins. Etienne stirred up the fire and left him alone. Once, long after, Matt roused to hear the rattle and the pounding of feet. The Indians were dancing again, and he was thankful to stay right where he was. Chapter 17. When Matt woke, the wigwam was dim, but the cracks of brightness around the door flap showed that it was daylight. By the sounds, the village was up and about. He could hear men's voices, the shouts of children, and the shrill yelping of dogs. Behind these sounds, there beat a dull thumping rhythm. Could the Indians still be dancing? He lay looking about him, at the smoke-streaked walls of woven matting, at the clutter of objects hanging here and there, shapeless garments, cooking pots, odd-shaped bags of animal skin, bundles of dried grasses and herbs. Under the platform where he had slept was an untidy pile of baskets and rolled-up mats. From the heap of ashes in the center of the dirt floor, a wisp of smoke curled upward toward the small hole in the roof. Much of it could not escape and drifted back to hang in thin clouds just above his head. Matt's throat felt tight with it,
and he sat up, coughing. Then he moved to the doorway, pushed back the flap, and stepped outside. As though they had been waiting, children came scuffling about him, their bright eyes curious. Most of them were naked as little frogs. "Quai," he said uncertainly, sending them into a chorus of giggles. Matt was relieved to see Etienne approaching. "You sleep long time," Etienne greeted him. "Too much bear, reckon." Matt smiled shamefacedly. He still found it hard to take Etienne's sober teasing. Over the heads of the children, he looked about the village. Last night, in the darkness and firelight, it had appeared mysterious and awesome. Now, under the strong sunlight, he saw that it was shabby and cluttered. There were a few bark cabins. For the most part, the wigwams were ramshackle and flimsy. On every side, from racks of untrimmed branches, hung rows of drying fish. Scattered heaps of clam shells and animal bones littered the ground. The Indians themselves had discarded the splendor of the night before. Some of them, like Etienne, wore only a breechcloth, others faded cloth trousers and ragged blankets. The women had replaced a bright finery with skirts and vests of dingy blue cotton. Now he could see what was making that rhythmic thumping. Two women were pounding corn in a huge mortar made from a tree trunk, their arms alternately rising and falling. Others nearby were grinding in smaller mortars of hollowed stones. They sat close together, jabbering like blue jays, but their chatter did not for an instant interfere with the steady rhythm of their bare arms. In front of another wigwam, two women were weaving baskets of rushes. As Matt and Etienne passed them, they looked up with shy smiles. All the women, Matt noticed, were hard at work. A few very old men sat smoking in front of the wigwams, and a group of boys squatted in a circle playing at some sort of game. "Where are the men?" he asked. "Gone," Etienne said. "Before sunup. My grandfather lead hunt for deer." He had brought a hunk of cornbread for each of them, and munching it, they walked through the village back to the canoe. Matt kept hanging back, looking all about him at the village. He wanted to stay longer. There were 100 questions he longed to ask, but Etienne seemed impatient. His genial mood of the night before had vanished. Without wasting a motion, he pushed the canoe into the water. A taggle of children had followed them and now stood on the bank, laughing and waving as they moved out into the river. Matt tried to find a reason for Etienne's silence. "If it hadn't been for me," he asked, "would you have gone on the deer hunt with the men?" Etienne did not like the question. "Not take me," he admitted finally. "I not have gun." "You're a good shot with a bow and arrow." Etienne scowled. "That old way," he said. "Good for children. Indian hunt now with white man's gun. Someday my grandfather buy me gun. Need many beaver skins. Beaver not so many now." "I know guns cost a lot," Matt said. "I'll have to wait a good while for another one myself." Etienne had long since heard the story of Ben's visit. "White man can buy with money," Etienne said. "Indian not have money. One time plenty wampum. Now wampum no good to pay for gun." There was bitterness in Etienne's voice. Matt understood now why Etienne had defended the beaver dam so fiercely. Was it true that beaver were getting scarce? Matt thought of the village they had just left. How very poor it seemed, how few possessions the Indians could boast. For the first time, Matt glimpsed how it might be for them, watching their old hunting grounds taken over by white settlers and by white traders demanding more skins than the woods could provide. As they set off through the forest, he tried to think of a way to lift Etienne's gloom. "That was a mighty fine feast," he said, "and I was glad to see where you live. I'd like to go there again someday." Etienne's scowl only deepened. "My grandmother not want you come to feast," he said finally. "My grandfather say you must. She say you not sleep in her house." "Oh," said Matt lamely, his own pleasure suddenly dimmed. So many things were suddenly clear to him. Why he had been left alone to sleep in the empty wigwam. Why Etienne had hurried him away so abruptly this morning. Etienne had been caught in a family argument and was annoyed about it. "My grandmother hate all white men," Etienne said. When Matt could find nothing to answer, Etienne went on. "White man kill my mother. She go out with 2 squaw to find bark for make basket. White man come through woods and shoot with gun. My mother do them no harm. We no longer at war with white men. Just same they kill for get scalp. White men get money for Indian scalp. Even scalp of children. Matt's indignant protest never got past his throat. He remembered that it was true, or had been a long time ago. He had heard that during the war, the Massachusetts governor had offered a bounty for Indian scalps. Atien must have been a very small child. My father go out on war trail, Atien said. He go to find white man who killed my mother. He not come back. Matt was speechless. He had never dreamed that anything like this lay behind Atien's carefree life. He had never wondered about Atien's parents at all. Only accepted, without question, that the boy followed his grandfather and obeyed him. No wonder she hates us, he said at last. Terrible things always happen when there's a war, on both sides. You've got to admit, Atien, that there was a reason. The Indians did the same thing to white settlers. The white women were afraid to go outside their cabins. Why white men make cabins on Indian hunting grounds? Matt had no answer to that. It was no use, he thought. The war with the French was over. The Indians and the English had made peace. But the hatred, would that ever be over? For all he and Atien walked through the woods together, there was a wall between them that Atien would never forget. In sudden panic, he thought of his own mother. Was it right for his father to bring her to this place? Does your grandfather hate us too? He asked. Atien did not answer at first. Finally, he said, My grandfather say Indian must learn to live with white man. It was not the answer Matt had hoped for. But Sakneese had said he must come to the feast. In spite of the grandmother, Sakneese had made him welcome. When my father comes, he said, I want him to know your grandfather. I think they would like each other. Atien did not answer, and they walked on in silence. Discomforted, Matt turned his attention to the trail they were following. Presently, he recognized the unmistakable carving of a little animal cut into the bark of a tree. But when he turned to Atien to boast of his recognition, he was silenced by the darkness in Atien's eyes. Instead, without speaking, he studied the signs they passed. He marked fallen trees pointing along the path, small piles of stones, and wherever the trail seemed to vanish, he discovered on a tree the sign of the beaver. When they came out at last on a trail he knew well, he marked carefully the spot where the two trails met. Why, he thought in sudden excitement, I could actually find my way to that village. I'm sure I could. But he did not share his thought with Atien. He knew that unless Atien took him there, he could never go to that village again. Sakneese had only invited him to the feast out of kindness, or perhaps out of fairness for his small share in killing the bear. Would he ever be given another chance? Chapter 18. Over and over, though he knew the number only too well, Matt counted his notched sticks. He kept hoping he had made a mistake. Always they were the same, 10 sticks. That meant that August had long since gone by. He couldn't remember exactly how many days belonged to each month, but any way he reckoned it, the month of September must be almost over. He only needed to look about him. The maple trees circling the clearing flamed scarlet. The birches and aspens glowed yellow, holding a sunlight of their own, even on misty days. The woods had become quieter. Jays still screamed at him, and chickadees twittered softly in the trees, but the songbirds had disappeared. Twice he had heard a faraway trumpeting, and had seen long straggles of wild geese, like trailing smoke, high in the air, moving south. In the morning, when he stepped out of the cabin, the frosty air nipped his nose. The noonday was warm as midsummer, but when he came inside at dusk, he hurried to stir up the fire. There was a chilliness inside him as well that neither the sun nor the fire ever quite reached. It seemed to him that day by day, the shadow of the forest moved closer to the cabin. Why was his family so late in coming? He was troubled, too, because the autumn weather seemed to have brought about a restlessness in Atien. There were days when the Indian boy did not come. He never offered a word of explanation. After a day or two, he would simply walk into the cabin and sit down at the table. He rarely suggested that they hunt or fish together. Day after day, Matt tramped the woods alone, trying to shake the doubts that walked beside him like his own shadow. As he walked, Matt was careful to cut blazes in the bark of trees. They gave him courage to walk farther into the forest than he had ever dared before, since he was sure of finding his way back to the cabin. He also watched for Indian signs, and sometimes he was sure he had detected one. One day, looking up, he saw on a nearby tree the sign of the turtle. Time to turn back, he told himself. He felt secure now in the territory of the beaver, but he wasn't so certain that a strange people would welcome a white trespasser. As he started to retrace his steps, he heard some distance away the sharp, high-pitched yelp of a dog. It didn't sound threatening, but neither did it sound like the happy, excited bark of a hound that had scented a rabbit. It sounded almost like the scream of a child. When it came again, it died away into a low whining, and he remembered the trapped fox. Eighteen had warned him to have nothing to do with a turtle trap, but he hesitated, and the sound came again. No matter what Eighteen had told him, he could not bring himself to walk away from that sound. Warily, he made his way through the brush. It was a dog, a scrawny Indian dog, dirt-caked and bloody. As Matt moved closer, he saw, through the blood, the white streak down the side of its face, then the chewed ear and the stubby porcupine quills. Only one dog in the world looked like that. It was caught by its foreleg, just as the fox had been, and it was frantic with pain and fear. Its eyes were glazed, and white foam dripped from its open jaws. Matt felt his own muscles tense with anger. His mind was made up in an instant. It had been bad enough to leave a fox to suffer. Turtle tribe or no, he was not going to walk away from Atien's dog. Somehow he had to get that dog out of the trap. But how? As he bent down, the dog snapped at him so ferociously that he jumped back. Even if it recognized him, Atien's dog had never learned to trust him. Now it was too crazed to understand that Matt meant to help. Matt set his teeth and stooped again. This time he got his hands on the steel bands of the trap and gave a tug. With a deep growl, the dog snapped at him again. Matt started, scraping his hand against the steel teeth. He leaped to his feet and stared at the red gash that ran from his knuckles to his wrist. It was no use, he realized. There was no way he could get that trap open with the dog in this maddened state. Somehow he would have to find Atien. He began to run through the forest, back over the way he had come, back along the trails he knew, searching his memory for the signs he remembered that led to the Indian village. Luck was with him. There was the sign of the beaver cut into a tree, and here were the fallen logs. He was never absolutely sure, but he knew he walked in the right direction, and after nearly an hour, to his great relief, he came out on the shore of the river. There was no canoe waiting, as there had been when Atien had led him there, but the river was narrow and placid. Thank goodness he had grown up near the ocean, and his father had taken him swimming from the time he could walk. He left his moccasins hidden under a bush and plunged in. In a few moments he came out, dripping, within sight of the stockade. He was greeted by a frenzied barking of dogs. They burst through the stockade and rushed toward him, halting only a few feet away, menacing him so furiously that he dared not take another step. Behind them came a group of girls who quieted the dogs with shrill cries and blows. "I have come for Atien," Matt said, when he could make himself heard. The girls stared at him, tired, wet, and ashamed of showing his fear of the dogs. Matt could not summon up any politeness or dignity. "Atien," he repeated impatiently. One girl, bolder than the others, answered him, flaunting her knowledge of the white man's language. "Atien not here," she told him. "Then Saknis." "Saknis not here. All gone hunt." Desperately, Matt seized his only remaining chance. "Atien's grandmother," he demanded. "I must see her." The girls looked at each other uneasily. Matt pulled back his shoulders and tried to put into his voice the stern authority that belonged to Saknis. "It is important," he said. "Please show me where to find her." Amazingly, his blustering had an effect. After some whispering, the girls moved back out of his way. "Come," the leading girl ordered, and he followed her through the gate. He was not surprised that she led him straight to the most substantial cabin in the clearing. He had recognized on the night of the feast that Saknis was a chief. Now, facing him in the doorway was a figure even more impressive than the old man. She was an aging woman, gaunt and wrinkled, but still handsome. Her black braids were edged with white. She stood erect, her lips set in a forbidding line, her eyes brilliant, with no hint of welcome. Could he make her understand? Matt wondered in confusion. "I'm sorry, ma'am," he began. "I know you don't want me to come here. I need help. 18's dog is caught in a trap, a steel trap. I tried to open it, but the dog won't let me near it." The woman stared at him. He could not tell whether she had understood a word. He started to speak again when the deerskin curtain was pushed aside and a second figure stood in the doorway. It was a girl, with long black braids hanging over her shoulders. She was dressed in blue, with broad bands of red and white beading. Strange, Matt thought. How much alike they looked, the old woman and the girl, standing side by side so straight and proud. "Me Marie, sister of Etienne," the girl said in a soft, low voice. "Grandmother not understand. I tell what you say." Matt repeated what he had said and then waited impatiently while she spoke to her grandmother. The woman listened. Finally, her grim lips parted in a single, scornful phrase. "Alamus pees wat," she said. "Good for nothing, dog." Matt's awe vanished in anger. "Tell her maybe it is good for nothing," he ordered the girl. 18 is fond of it, and it's hurt. Hurt bad. We've got to get it out of that trap." There was distress in the girl's eyes as she turned again to her grandmother. He could see that she was pleading, and that in spite of herself, the old woman was relenting. After a few short words, the girl went into the cabin and came back in a moment, holding in her hand a large chunk of meat, a small blanket folded over her arm. "Me go with you," she said. "Dog know me." In his relief, Matt forgot the torn hand he had been holding behind him. Instantly, the old woman moved forward and snatched at it. Her eyes questioned him. "It's nothing," he said hastily. "I almost got the trap open." She gave his arm a tug, commanding him to follow her. "There isn't time," he protested. She silenced him with a string of words of which he understood only the scornful peaswat. "She say dog not go away," the girl explained. "Better you come. Trap maybe make poison." Having no choice, Matt followed them into the cabin. He saw now that the woman's straight posture had been a matter of pride. She was really very lame and stooped as she walked ahead of him. While she busied herself over the fire, he sat obediently on a low platform and looked about him. He was astonished that the little room, strange and so unlike his mother's kitchen, seemed beautiful. It was very clean. The walls were lined with birch bark and hung with woven mats and baskets of intricate design. The air was sweet with fresh grasses spread on the earth floor. Without speaking, the woman tended him, washing his hand with clean, warm water. From a painted gourd, she scooped a pungent-smelling paste and spread it over the wound, then bound his hand with a length of clean blue cotton. "Thank you," Matt said when she had finished. "It feels better." She dismissed him with a grunting imitation of Saknis's "good." The girl, who had been watching, moved swiftly to the door. As Matt rose to follow her, the grandmother held out to him a slab of cornbread. He had not realized how hungry he was, and he accepted it gratefully. The girl took the lead, brushing aside the curious children and the still suspicious dogs. At the river's edge, she untied a small canoe, and Matt stepped into it, thankful that his half-dried clothes would not have to be drenched again. Once on the forest trail, she set the pace, and he did not find it easy to keep up with her swift, silent stride. She was so like Etienne, though lighter and more graceful. After a time, Matt ventured to break the silence. "You speak good English," he said. "Etienne tell me about you," she answered. "You tell him good story."
"Etienne didn't tell me he had a sister."
The girl laughed. "Etienne think squaw girl not good for much," she said. "Etienne only like to hunt." "I have a sister too," he told her. "She's coming soon." "What's she name?"
"Sarah. She's younger than you."
"But Marie isn't an Indian name, is it?" Matt asked. "Is Christian name. Me baptized by father." Etienne had never mentioned a priest either, but Matt knew that the French Jesuits had lived with the Indians here in Maine long before the English settlers came. "When my sister comes, Will you come with Atien to see her? He asked.
It might be so, she answered politely.
She sounded as though it never would be. At last they heard the yelping just ahead of them, and they both began to run. Even in his terror, the dog recognized the girl and greeted her with a frantic beating of his tail. He gulped at the meat she held out to him, but he still would not let either of them touch the trap. The girl had come prepared for this, and she unfolded the blanket she had carried, threw it over the dog's head, and gathered the folds behind him. With surprising strength, she held the struggling bundle tightly in her arms, while Matt took the trap in both hands and slowly forced the jaws open. In a moment, the dog was free, escaping the blanket, bounding away from them on three legs, the fourth paw dangling at an odd angle.
I'm afraid it's broken, Matt said.
He was still breathing hard from that last run and from the effort of tugging those steel jaws apart.
Atien mend, the girl said, folding up the blanket as calmly as though she were simply tidying up a cabin. The dog hobbled slowly after them along the trail, lying down now and then to lick at the bleeding paw. They made slow progress, and now that the worry was over, Matt was aware how tired he was. It seemed as though he had been walking back and forth over that trail all day, and the way to the village seemed endless. He was thankful when, halfway to the river, he saw Atien approaching swiftly along the trail.
My grandmother sent me, he explained. You get dog out?
I couldn't do it alone, Matt admitted. Atien stood watching as the dog came limping toward him.
Dog very stupid, he said. No good for hunt. No good for smell, turtle smell. What for I take back such foolish dog?
His harsh words did not fool Matt for a moment, nor did they fool the dog. The scruffy tail thumped joyfully against the earth. The brown eyes looked up at the Indian boy with adoration. Atien reached into his pouch and brought out a strip of dried meat. Then he bent and very gently took the broken paw into his hands.
Chapter 19.
Grandmother say you come to village today, Atien announced 2 days later.
That's kind of her, Matt answered. But my hand is just about healed. It doesn't need any more medicine.
Not for medicine.
Matt waited uncertainly.
My grandmother very surprised white boy go long way for Indian dog, Atien explained. She say you welcome.
So once again Matt crossed the river into the Indian stockade. This time, though the dogs barked at him and children stared and giggled, he did not feel so much like a stranger.
Sockneys held out a hand of welcome. Atien's grandmother did not exactly smile, but her thin lips were less grim. Behind her, Atien's sister smiled but did not speak. The old woman dipped a clamshell ladle into a kettle and filled three bowls with a stew of fish and corn, then drew back while Atien and Sockneys and Matt ate their meal in silence. Neither she nor Marie ate till the men were finished. After the meal, Atien did not hurry him away. He rather grandly played host and led Matt about the village. He was amused when Matt kept stopping every few feet to watch what the women were doing. Matt was filled with curiosity. He knew well enough that Atien was scornful of the squaw work the white boy had to do, but Atien didn't have to worry about what he was going to eat next day. There were so many things Matt wanted to learn. He observed carefully as two women pounded dried kernels of corn between two rounded stones, catching the coarse flour on a strip of birch bark. He marked how they spread berries on bark so that the sun dried them hard as pebbles. He admired the baskets made of a single strip of birch bark, bent and fastened at the corners so tightly that water could be boiled inside. I must remember that, he resolved. I could do that myself if I tried. For a time, Atien good-naturedly answered his questions. Finally, he grew impatient of squaw work. He led Matt toward a cluster of boys who squatted in a circle in the dirt pathway, absorbed in some noisy game. The boys widened their ring to make room for two more, and Matt crouched awkwardly on his heels to watch them. One after the other, they were shaking six smooth bone discs in a wooden bowl and tossing them out onto the ground. Each disc was marked on one side with a band of red paint. When each boy had had a turn, the one who had thrown the most discs to land painted side up was proclaimed the winner. And with much gloating, he collected from each of the others a number of small sticks.
Then they handed the bowl to Matt. His luck was good. 5 of the discs showed red bands, and with laughter and clowning, the others piled up before him a little heap of sticks. What was so exciting about this simple game, he wondered, to cause so much shouting? The bowl went rapidly round the circle. The sticks kept changing hands, and presently he had the answer. One of the boys had no sticks left to pay. With a mocking groan, he unclasped from his arm a wide copper band and tossed it to the winner. So that's it, Matt thought silently. Sooner or later, I'm bound to lose too, and when I do, what will they expect me to forfeit? He did not have long to wait. At his next turn, every one of his discs landed blank side up. Ruefully, he handed over the last of the sticks he had won. There was a gleeful shout, and then they waited. What do I have? He thought desperately. Nothing in his pocket but his jackknife, and his very life depended upon that knife. Then the boy nearest him reached over and jerked roughly at the sleeve of his shirt. Matt pretended not to understand, and the boy tugged harder. 2 of the others got to their feet, plainly ready to tear the shirt from his back. Etienne made no move to help him. Grimly, he pulled the shirt over his head and tossed it to the winner. Served him right, he supposed. His father had always forbidden him to gamble. But what was he going to do without that shirt? It was the only one he had. Now Etienne put an end to the game. He leaped to his feet and produced from nowhere a soft ball made of deerskin. Instantly, the others raced off in all directions and came back carrying thin sticks. One of these was thrust at Matt. It was a curious sort of bat, light and flexible, with a wide, flat curve at the tip. Forgetting his humiliation, Matt suddenly grinned. With a bat in his hand, he could hold his own with any Indian. The boys back in Quincy could have told them that. Eagerly, he joined in the scramble of choosing sides, but never had he played a game like this, so fast and merciless. The ball could not be touched by hand or foot. It was kept flying through the air by the sticks alone. If it fell to the ground, some player scooped it up with the tip of his bat and sent it spinning again. The Indian boys were bewilderingly quick and skillful, and they wielded their bats with no heed for each other's heads, and certainly not for Matt's. It was no accident, he knew, when an elbow jabbed suddenly into his right eye. These boys were putting him to the test. Ignoring the blows that fell on his head and shoulders, Matt swung grimly at the whirling ball, missing it over and over, but sometimes feeling the satisfying thwack of bat against leather. He was thankful now that he had no shirt. If only he could be wearing a breechcloth instead of tight English breeches. But there was no time for